Window World is proud to present Kevin Keatsman Has Issues. Simply the best for less at WindowsKansasCity.com.
Well, I may have just located my brother from another mother. And if not that, certainly a kindred spirit, especially when it comes to COVID and what we did in America for over 3 years. Through a mutual friend, I was turned on to a book called Fauci's Fiction, the book on COVID, how the government and modern medicine missed the boat on COVID-19 from day one. The author is Dr. Michael J. Schwartz, and you're about to meet him in just a few minutes. This is one of the most fascinating conversations you'll ever hear. Now, I say we could be brothers from another mother, but I don't quite have the resume that Dr. Schwartz has. This guy's been an entrepreneur for 30 years. He owns and operates 3 medical clinics in New Jersey and Florida. His company was the first in New Jersey to start conducting COVID-19 testing. Over the course of his career, he's done pretty much everything with a whole bunch of different companies. He's a private pilot. Insane, right? He's a former police officer, a stand-up comedian, and he's an expert on body language and communication. He teaches a course in it. He helps private entities and government entities around the world. And the stand-up comedy, well, I think you're going to find his personality to be really something. This book is amazing, as is Dr. Schwartz. He's founded the charity Hometown Heroes in 2008, credited with distributing over $3 million in funds to people who need it. That's pretty cool stuff. He's even awarded the prestigious Robin Hood Service Award. And now he's got a book on COVID for just about anyone that chronicles everything we did wrong from Fauci's day one. The picture art, the cover art on this book is sensational. It's basically animation or a cartoon of Fauci with his hair a little disheveled, his ears sticking way out because he has a mask on, glasses over his mask, and a Pinocchio nose coming out from underneath the mask for all the lies that he has told. It is fantastic. You can find this book pretty much anywhere. Fauci's Fiction, the book on COVID. You're going to love this conversation. Brought to you by Joslin's Jewelry, 95th and Antioch, in Overland Park. The jeweler you'll recommend to your friends and family or online at joslinsjewelry.com. Bstock.net, it's back to school time at Bstock. They've got hundreds of different laptops, desktops, and tablet computers from Dell, Lenovo, Apple, and HP. Hundreds of different models, all typically 30% or more off from Best Buy or Nebraska Furniture Mart. If you're looking for something specific for your student, shoot them an email, sales@bstock.net, or log on to bstock.net, or visit their warehouse in Olathe, 14680 South Flaming Road. And my friend Brad at the New Car Image, your personal concierge for all your vehicles, whether it's fleet vehicles for your business or just your personal car that you really aren't very good at or don't have the time to detail and keep looking the way you want. Right now, through the month of August, 15% off using the promo code online KKHI, or just call Brad, mention the podcast, and save 15% on any service of detailing or even DMV services or whatever it is that you'd like to have them do for you. Your personal concierge is the newcarimage.com. I can't tell you how much fun this is going to be talking about this new book. It is sensational. You've got to check it out. Fauci's Fiction, the book on COVID. We're going to talk about the book and so much more about what we did right, what we did wrong, and Dr. Schwartz is a huge baseball fan. We'll even spend some time on that right now on KKHI. Hit it!
The KK Has Issues conversation is presented by Roberts Robinson Chevrolet Buick GMC. Shop, click, drive at robertsrobinson.com.
All right, Dr. Schwartz joins us now, and this is going to be really interesting. We love this new book that is coming out. Hello, Dr. Schwartz. How are you today? Everything good in your world?
Hey, Kevin. Fantastic. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's set this thing up. I've told everybody your bio and what you've done. You're really an interesting guy. Not only are you a doctor, and we can get into exactly your researcher, but you've done so many different things. You've been a police officer, stand-up comedy, body language expert. You got all kinds of things going on in your world. How do you focus on exactly what you wanted your life to be?
Oh, God. Great question. You know, that changes with the day. And it's funny. A lot of folks ask me, what are you going to do in 5 years? The answer is, I don't know. You know, as an entrepreneur, you just kind of roll with the punches and see what the next opportunity is. But a lot of good stuff in my life that I enjoy doing, like the stand-up. The honest answer is, I just don't know.
When did you know you didn't want to work for other people and you wanted to start and run your own businesses and do your own thing?
I was 17 years old. I moved out when I was 15, 17 years old. I started my first company. And, you know, once you work for somebody, it's really hard to go to work for somebody else. I think you become unhireable at that point as well.
That's me. I'm officially unhireable. I'm not for sale. So that's out. I'm not going to be hired again the rest of my life. That's over. But so, okay. I just want to go back to when you were like a police officer and you did that and you're thinking, okay, I need to work for myself. I need to have my own business. How old were you when you were a cop? And then what did you do right after that?
Yeah, I became a cop midlife crisis. I was 29 years old when I went to the police academy. I had been in business for about 12 years at that point, lost a giant contract, municipal contract that we had. And I was just kind of burnt out, you know, doing the same thing. At that point, it was 12 years and I had been an auxiliary police officer in my hometown as a volunteer helping out. And a buddy of mine said, hey, you like doing that? Why don't you become a cop? And I immediately said no, but then the wheels started turning. And as I was calling a few friends of mine and, you know, police chiefs. One of my good friends, Tommy Boyd, who's the chief of police in Seaside Heights, said, I'll hire you. Next thing you know, my head is shaved. I'm in the academy. And I think the first day in the academy, Kevin, I realized I can't do this forever, but it was a great opportunity, a great experience to have that education. Not only that, but to work as a police officer and kind of see the other side and, you know, I worked for somebody for a little while, but I immediately got back into business right after I got out of the academy.
Did you have any dangerous moments?
I did. I mean, you know, Seaside Heights is one of those towns. I'm sure you've seen it on, you know, TV, the Jersey Shore, which it's definitely not what they portray on TV, but it's a summer shore town, drinking town. And back when I was there, the clubs were all open. It was a lot of fun, a couple dangerous moments here and there, you know, some drug arrests, you know, foot chases, car chases, things of that nature. But, you know, we always went home safe at the end of the night.
All right. So how about broadcasting and podcasting? You're obviously very natural at this as well. Do you do a lot of that?
I'm on a lot of TV. I do a lot of radio. I've been doing that for years. My national charity kind of put us in the spotlight back when Hurricane Sandy hit. I had done about 1,000 events in over a 2-year period. I'm just kind of, you know, this is normal for me. It's like, what do we have today, staff? You know, right. So, but everyone is fantastic and, you know, great to be on your, I've heard so many great things about your podcast and I listen to a bunch myself.
Well, that's kind of you. Thank you. So when do we start? We should do a podcast. You and I, it sounds like I don't have the resume you have. Like mine's been in media my whole life. But I love what I know about you. I love what I've read about you and your book and the things that you're doing. And it seems just such a natural, you know, there's just some people in the world that just go after it every single day. Sure. And you strike me as the guy that goes after it. And I know you do a lot of charity things and you're involved in a lot of great projects, but this book you've written to me is in your own way. And I think just by the cover, and I've already mentioned this to our listeners, the cover alone says, we know what kind of fraud this was. I mean, where did you get the idea for the cover? Fauci's Fiction, the book on COVID. Where did you get the idea for the cover and what tone do you believe that sets for the book?
Well, I'm going to tell you, it came to me in a vision and it sounds so, you know, apropos. It really did though. I'm sitting around and I own 3 medical clinics. We're doing this stuff. We were actually the first company in New Jersey to conduct the COVID test. And I have clinics here in New Jersey. I'm in New Jersey right now and down in Florida. So we're doing this for a living. We're seeing people. And of course, you know, at first we're testing folks and we're outside on their porches with PPE. We're taking this thing very, very seriously. But as time went on, we started to realize this is not exactly matching what they're saying on TV. You know, we're seeing the majority of our folks come back asymptomatic. Most of them are recovering in a day or two. And on TV, they're talking about doom and gloom. So we have been doing this for, you know, years. And I want to say it's about 2 years in. I've been wanting to write a book, thinking about what I wanted on the cover. And I just all of a sudden I'm picturing, you know, Dr. Fauci on TV giving those briefings. And I'm thinking, and I said to my girlfriend at the time, I said, hey, you know what? What about, you know, a Pinocchio Fauci with like a nose coming through the mask? And that cover, what you see on the cover is exactly what I saw in my head. So we're getting a lot of flack on it, a lot of compliments, of course, and I appreciate that, but also a lot of flack from the other side.
It seems to me everybody, it should be a meme all over the internet for one, and a lot of people should use that as like their Twitter profile or something, the photo that they have. It's so perfect that he's sitting there, his hair is disheveled, his ears are sticking out because of the mask, and the Pinocchio nose is sticking out below that. And as I kind of thought through this thing, they were lying to us. I don't trust... First of all, my point of reference is I don't trust much of what I hear. Now, I've covered people my whole life, people in positions of authority, whether it's, you know, we've had elections here locally, mayors, governors trying to spend $3 billion on a project or stadiums or things like that, people that own sports teams, people that manage or general manage sports teams. And what I've learned through my life is the more important somebody thinks they are, the more likely they are to just completely fraud you, just lie to you, tell you something they want you to think, and it's not truthful. So I approach everything with great skepticism, and we did that with COVID. Like, I didn't believe a word they were saying about taking the jab. I was like, I'd already had COVID by the time the jab came out. I'm like, why the hell would I take this thing? I've already had it, and it didn't do much. So I can't believe what they were able to perpetrate on the American public. Are you surprised what happened?
A little bit, but you know, I've been through life. I've been around the block a few times. So, you know, you kind of take everything with a grain of salt. One of the things I write about in the book is anytime somebody tells you something, you should always ask the question based on what, you know, as a scientist, as somebody who looks at this stuff and analyzes it, you know, you hear a lot of things. And what's the old saying, you know, don't believe anything you hear, but only half of what you see. A lot of people are throwing around erroneous information all the time. You know, this one heard this from this one and that one heard it from that one. And I want to know where the source is. So as they're talking about this thing, of course, you know, we're all glued to the TV like everybody else, trying to figure out what everybody knows about this. Let's put it all in context. But as my company was out there on the ground actually dealing with patients, we're recording things like symptomology. We're recording, you know, how long the person is sick. And this was a, you got to remember, Kevin, this didn't all happen in one day. This was a 3-year timeline of, you know, learning a little bit about the virus itself, learning a little bit about testing and timelines, and then kind of relaying that to the next grouping of patients that we had. And in total, we had 19,000 patients. So as we're seeing things happen on the ground, you know, we're telling folks like, hey, look, everybody's got this thing and nobody's really dying from it. As a matter of fact, I had 4,000 positive patients from my grouping and we didn't lose one. I had 4 in total out of 4,000 go to the hospital. So here they are telling everybody they got to get a vaccine for something, and I'm going, dude, everybody's surviving this thing. Like, what are they trying to say? And I to put it in context for you, we did not recommend a vaccine because we thought the vaccine was going to have issues for people. We didn't recommend the vaccine at all because we knew it didn't work. I mean, that was just the bottom line. Why would I give you something experimental for something that all of my patients are surviving and getting through quite easily? It just didn't make any sense to us.
Yeah, I think when I look back on it, I think maybe the first 6 months of COVID, we were all trying to, well, it didn't take me 6 months to figure out that I was not at risk. I think we learned that very early, that it doesn't really affect kids. It affects older people more than younger people. People that are obese or diabetic or have an illness or cancer or something like that, much more than somebody that's healthy. We learned that pretty quickly, I feel. But as I look back on the whole of it all, the first 6 or 8 months, the whole country was scared. We were locked down. We were shut down in May of 20 and beyond. And we had all these things going on. And then almost on cue, the election happened and things changed. And it went from being reported that we don't know what we're doing. Trump's a buffoon. You know, the daily briefings they had, Trump was just this complete buffoon. Can you believe he's doing this every day with the most transparent thing you could possibly do? And that is, here's our experts answering questions every single day for the American public, which I thought was a great service, but it actually hurt him because the media criticized Trump for doing that. He loses the election. And then all of a sudden it just becomes one voice. And it really got weird. And you mentioned in an interview that I saw you do with Ed Henry that COVID stopped being tracked pretty much about the time Biden took office. What changed when the politics changed here?
Well, it's very simple. And this has been the topic of conversation lately. And I try to explain this, and it's hard to do, you know, over the radio or on a podcast, but if you can kind of imagine a graph, those numbers in the beginning, when people started seeing the numbers of COVID go up in the beginning, that huge spike we had, that wasn't the amount of COVID that was out there. That was the amount of COVID we could catch up with the limited amount of testing supplies we had. So the graph starts going up. And all of a sudden, when the labs realized that there was a national shortage, the labs actually did something ingenious, and they validated buccal swabs. They created their own medium. They got it validated with the FDA. And the next thing you know, I have thousands and thousands of samples. So all of a sudden that graph goes way up and you see the huge spike. But you got to remember that the reported cases, Kevin, that we had back then, we only had PCR testing. Labs by law have to report to the state and the county. So the numbers you saw in the beginning of COVID were fairly accurate once we had enough testing supplies. And you saw this huge spike. Everybody in the country had it. So at that point, we knew the death rate was going to be very low. And everybody in the, you know, in the world almost at that point had it or had it at that point. When you introduce rapid testing to the public and you give free rapid tests to every household in the country, None of those get reported. None of that. Nobody's calling from their home saying, hey, I just got a, you know, rapid positive. I want to report myself in quarantine for 2 weeks. Nobody does that. So the numbers artificially, of course, go straight down. Now, as soon as the CARES Act, and this is a lot of, I know there's a lot of information at one time, but when the CARES Act expired and nobody had access to free COVID testing anymore, all of a sudden those numbers just dropped off the face of the earth. So now, and it's funny, I just had a PhD call me today because I told him 3 weeks ago, I said, we're having a spike in COVID right now, but nobody's talking about it. And he called me today and he goes, you were right. He goes, I'm in a meeting right now and our numbers are through the roof. I mean, COVID is like everywhere. It's never going away. The problem is when you know it's out there and you know it's not deadly, big deal. But when you come on TV and you start, you know, propping up the numbers, it all of a sudden becomes a political narrative. And that's what we dealt with for the last 3 years.
Man, we look back on so much of this stuff. Now they're saying that the deaths were with COVID, not from COVID. We've got so many different variations of this thing. They told us about the jab and said, look, if you take the shot, you can't get it and you can't give it. And this is your responsibility as part of a society to go get this shot for your fellow humans, your fellow citizens, and all these things. You spotted pretty early on that they were that they should have known better, that they probably knew better or should have known better. We point to Fauci all the time, which is obviously what the book is about. To me, it's even bigger than that, Dr. Schwartz. We're talking about thousands of people that had to be complicit, from doctors, media personnel, major organizations around the country, that must have known at some point fairly early on, this jab is not really working, but we're going to lie to people and keep telling them it is. And now we've seen the hundreds of millions of dollars that the NIH and Fauci himself and his elite group of people that were running the thing made from the pharmaceutical companies. It almost looks like this was just one big grift.
Yeah, it's hard to, you know, you got to have a lot of people for a conspiracy theory, so I don't get into that. I just tell people about the facts. And the book itself is not about Fauci, but at the same time, it has everything to do with Fauci, because in my mind, he was the face of COVID. But when you look at the other practitioners, I talk to even medical students. Medical students would tell me, hey, we got to get on the same page. We got to be trusted. We got to make sure that people, you know, that people trust the medical community. And I'm going, dude, you're doing us a disservice by touting this narrative, because I'm telling you, I deal in this every day, and this is not what I'm seeing. Most of the doctors who talked on this on a daily basis did not have any experience with COVID. They didn't test one patient. They didn't treat a patient. They didn't see it in at least the mass numbers that we had. We have something called horizontal data, which I don't think anybody else in the country has, at least from, you know, from my perspective and what we do. But we tested a lot of the same people every single week, whether it was a police department, school district. These are people who forced their employees to test every Wednesday, for instance. And we would show up, and we have 3 years worth of data on if that, you know, if a cop had it 3 times, how many times was he asymptomatic? What was his viral load? Did he have a co-infection? There's a lot of information that goes into COVID to understand it in totality. COVID isn't just positive or negative. You have to understand the caveats to that specific person to understand in totality if that person is sick, you know, and why they're not sick and what symptomology they have. There's a lot to it. So when you have a doctor talking on TV, just kind of spouting the CDC narrative, they don't really understand it. And most of the time, it would take the media about a year, sometimes 18 months, to catch up to what we were seeing on the ground. So when Biden was on TV saying, hey, if you get this vaccine, you can't get it, you can't give it, my staff's looking at each other, shaking their heads, laughing, going, are they serious? Does he really believe this? Or is somebody lying to him? The CDC narrative was very clear. But the CDC narrative did not match the reality of what we saw on the ground every single day.
Well, and I think the single most frustrating part of all this is when people were trying to get treatment during COVID, and Joe Rogan, well, Trump first, when he went into the hospital, they made fun of what he was taking and basically reported, oh, he's going to die. They don't know what they're doing. Like the doctors, right. The president's doctors don't know what they're doing. But then Joe Rogan really became the face of it by taking ivermectin. Oh, he's taking horse medicine from a veterinarian. This is going to kill him. He's crazy. He's all this. Well, now that's what they say to give, right? Ivermectin, if you get COVID and you need treat and you want to help. They never even opened up the possibility that you could treat this thing. It was portrayed to the American people, there is nothing we can give you. If you get it, you're going to die. You better take this jab. That is how I remember COVID. Am I crazy?
No, you're not crazy. In fact, you know, we saw this going on. I dealt with a doctor who used ivermectin religiously. We really didn't in our healthcare clinic. However, and I talk about it a little bit in the book because I don't have a lot of experience with it. But for the most part, let me digress. Medicine is a practice. Any practitioner should have the option to try something. Ivermectin was approved for human use in, I think, 1987. Hydroxychloroquine is used in many other countries. for a number of different ailments. These things are safe. They're effective for certain things. Should we try it for COVID? Absolutely. Does it work for COVID? I mean, personal opinion, when I had a patient who was sick from COVID, most of the time, once the fever broke, they would recover within 2 days. Okay. So there was a timeline to somebody not only catching COVID and it incubating, but by the time they actually caught it, how long were their symptoms and their symptomology going to last? For the most part, if somebody took ivermectin, it was usually about the same. But the bottom line is, should anybody have the right to use it? Absolutely. I mean, these things are safe. They're effective for other things. Why not is the question. For somebody to bash that on national TV, talk about, you know, Trump and Joe Rogan, and these guys were doing everything they could to get the message out to say, hey, why not? You know, other doctors seem to be having success with it. Let's use it. So it was a little fishy to us as we're watching the, you know, the CDC narrative versus what we're doing here, like I said, on the ground. But the two didn't match. It was quite obvious right off the bat.
So where are we today in your community? And I mean, doctors all around the country, researchers and doctors around the country, how they view it. If we were, you know, where were we, let's say, 6 months into COVID? Was it, you know, 80% of the doctors out there were on board basically with everything that Fauci was saying? If it was 80%, then what is it now? What is the medical and research community like in America looking back at how we did this?
It's still split. You ask a great question, because right in the beginning of COVID, most of those doctors shut their doors. You know, pediatricians, primary care doctors, they shut their doors. They didn't want to bring home to their family what they could be treating in the office. We didn't do that. We were one of the only ones open. So it was quite funny when someone would walk into our office to get a COVID test in order to see their primary care doctor. So I don't take a lot of what they say very seriously, but the ones that stood up and said, hey, there's something wrong here, you know, like masking, we don't do that. I mean, the mask is the second dumbest thing I've ever seen in my lifetime. The jab being the first, that one takes the cake. But when you watch these other doctors, it seems like there's a bit of cognitive distortion still going on. Because if you bought into the narrative early on and you told all of your patients, this is what I believe, now that you've seen the evidence that's contrary to that, a lot of them haven't come around. A lot of them are still fighting the good fight. And it baffles my mind. I mean, science evolves, science changes. I thought in the beginning when this started, when we started testing in March of 2020, I thought, but for sure, by, you know, maybe September, 6 months into it, we would have figured it out and said, okay, this isn't as bad as it, you know, we thought it could be. Let's open up the schools. Let's open up the businesses, give people their lives back. They kept running with it. And a lot of those doctors today are still running with that narrative. It's quite comical, but at the same time, a little scary.
Okay. Yesterday, my wife, doctor, got one of those text things or his text chain thing. And it was a petition. It said, please sign this petition if you would like Fauci to be arrested. And she thought that was pretty cool. And it wasn't just clickbait, I guess. She went back and, you know, opened it up and read what it was. And there's an actual petition going around nationally to do this. Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, has been behind a lot of these things. Rand Paul has just unequivocally won every argument and debate he ever had with Anthony Fauci. That's over. We can go back and look at the facts now. And that's just a done deal. And I think what Rand Paul and others in D.C. are implying on the right is that Fauci knew better and continued to say the stuff and has also remarked publicly, well, I couldn't, you know, Fauci essentially said at one point, I couldn't tell America the truth because they couldn't handle it, you know? And when you start saying things like that and you've made $100 million off of this thing, we now get into an area where people are starting to say, was this criminal? Do you believe Anthony Fauci if he was lying to the American public about what he knew, misleading people, that should be a crime?
Kevin, withholding information from the public is the same as lying. And that's, you know, my opinion. As a former police officer, I mean, I didn't know much about federal law. I don't know what law would apply here. When you they did everything under a federal emergency. So I think they think they're in the clear. You would need a lot more pressure from guys like Rand Paul and people like us to say, hey, what did you know and when did you know it? Will they ever admit to it? I don't know. I doubt it. And, you know, you get into the whole money trail and let's follow the money and see the why. At the end of the day, I don't really care about the why. I care about, you know, the fact that they did it. It's just criminal. I mean, the amount of suicides, the amount of kids that were locked out of school, the people that lost their jobs and businesses, nurses who were fired, police officers who were fired. To me, that's criminal. Who do you hold accountable? I mean, they had protection. When you look at the doctors who gave the shots, everybody's immune. The companies who made the shots, they're all immune. So they did this the right way. but you know, for themselves, obviously the wrong way for the public. And this government was not looking out for the public. They were not listening to practitioners like us from the start. People like me were getting censored, banned, ridiculed for saying things like, "Hey guys, you know, maybe we should adopt the Swedish model because they seem to be having the same curve we're having." And people would come back to us and say, "You're going to kill people. You're going to, you know, it's just, when I look at it in totality, yeah, there's some kind of criminality there, but what law applies is the big question.
The book is called Fauci's Fiction, the book on COVID. You're going to love the cover. You can't miss it. You can get it on Amazon or pretty much anywhere. Dr. Michael Schwartz is the author of Fauci's Fiction. I always love when I have authors on to ask them about the process of writing a book. You've obviously done a lot of things. What was the process for you on this book? I know you wanted to get a message out, certainly, but as far as actually writing a book, what was that experience like for you? And what is your writing process?
Sure. What's in the book, I probably had the exact same conversation with thousands and thousands of patients, because they would come in my office wearing a mask, scared, you know, to asking me questions about the vaccine. And I would just relay to them what we were seeing. By the time they were out of my office, and sometimes I'd spend an hour with a patient, you know, a lot of them would say, "Wow, I got more information from you and, you know, in this short period of time than I did from all the briefings I watched in any of the news outlets. You should really write a book." So somebody obviously planted the seed one day, and I wanted to sit down and write it. And my staff looked at me and said, "Well, this will be interesting, and it's probably going to be easy for you because you've had the same conversation with everybody. They've heard it a million times." So, you know, you sit down and you figure out what you want to talk about. I could probably have added, you know, at least 10 chapters to this book. There's so much out there. But when you've never written a book before, you go out, you start talking to people who have, and they give you a lot of advice. You know, keep it under 200 pages if you want it to sell. You know, make sure you do this. Make sure you get it edited. Make sure you get a great cover designer. So there's a lot of people in the process, and it was definitely a learning process for me. I'd love to do it again, but it was a lot of work. My dad passed away right in the middle of writing the book, and he had 3 Pfizers. And at that point, I looked at my fiance and I said, "Hey, I think I need to finish this thing," because there was a story there too. So I sat down and I finally, you know, buckled through it, went through the editing process, and you know, lo and behold, here's the book. But there's so much in that. I wish everybody in the country would read it. It would really give them a full understanding of what they just dealt with for 3 years. But right now we're getting so much pushback. Even Amazon won't let me promote the book due to what they said was current events, in their words. And they sent me 2 letters saying, "I can't spend money to promote my own book that they make money off of." Isn't it? You know, it's crazy. Facebook will suppress posts with the book in it. And the amount of flack that I'm getting back from people who haven't even read a word just on that cover is quite crazy. And it shows you how divided this country still is.
You know, what a shame we don't have the bookstores like we used to, because bookstores were pretty simple places. If you could put a book in there that people would buy off the shelf over and over and over, they'd just keep restocking it. And that's not the world we live in anymore. And I honestly believe we've just got such a suppression of free speech in this country, and big tech is so involved in that. It's frightening. It is frightening. So you're literally having a hard time getting this book out there to people.
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm getting a lot of, you know, we're doing a lot of press, a lot of interviews, and that's great. That kind of keeps us in the forefront. And the book is selling, but not to the point, you know, it could be. And if everybody in the country saw this cover and you've seen it, obviously it would attract a little attention, and they want to know what's in it. But at the end of the day, it's the truth. You know, it's not political in any nature. I didn't want to go there. I just wanted to put the facts out as we saw it, the data that we derived from testing all these folks and dealing with all these people. And hey, we talk about everything from not just testing, but antibodies and how long the antibodies last, what we're seeing specifically from patients who have been vaccinated, what things are coming back, how that gets reported to theirs, because most of the stuff that is out there, you'll never hear about. So that is all in the book. It's really just the truth of COVID, specifically just the data. And the folks that think, you know, we're beating up Fauci, we're not. But, you know, if you read the data in the book, at the end of the day, your opinion of Fauci, it might change a little bit.
All right. So we've got some friends, and I think everybody pretty much knows people that got the shot, and their life somehow, they've got complications or something physically different or wrong with them. And they've all had doctors now say, "Yes, we believe this could be from taking that. It was experimental and you could be having these issues." You mentioned your dad and the 3 Pfizers that he took. I don't know if you believe that was a big factor in his health condition, but the epidemic that I'm seeing in what my industry has been my whole professional life in athletics is all these teenage and 20-something men just dropping, Bronny James, mm-hmm. LeBron James' son, just collapsing with a cardiac arrest at age 19 while practicing basketball for no reason. He's at the Mayo Clinic. They won't say. Many of these athletes will never say, oh, it was or wasn't that. I'm not commenting. And we've seen deaths, too. We had one here in a suburban Kansas City of a smaller college football player dropped earlier this year. They claimed it was from the heat on an 84-degree day. This is what the media does, even at the local level. I don't buy it. Are we seeing more athletes collapse? And when they collapse, what's the first thing you think?
It's hard to put that in context, and I'll tell you why. We have a 24-hour news cycle, right? So, 24-hour news cycle now, in contrast to, 20 years ago, you might think that we're just seeing all of the news. And I know people speculate. And yeah, of course, it runs through my mind because you got to get into the why, right? When someone gets the shot, it's as bad as having COVID. The cytokines from that shot will travel around your system for at least 2 weeks. Your ACE2 receptors pick that up. And what we see in practice is it causes area of inflammation in areas of instability. So when you look at somebody like my dad and what his autopsy came back with, we see the exact same thing with people that are having complications from the shot. My dad had an enlarged heart twice the size it should have been, which was not detected before the autopsy. He threw a clot in his coronary artery, and his kidneys looked like they were going to fail. And unfortunately, and I had begged my dad during this whole thing, I said, Dad, you do not need this shot. You do not want this shot. You're going to get COVID anyway. It's a myth that you can't get as sick if you've had the shot. That is a complete myth. In fact, you can be sicker if you've had multiple shots and then you contract COVID. And those cytokines travel around and they inflame areas. I got people with joint problems. By the way, I get clotting from all three shots. And when I say all three, I'm talking about the three that we have experience with. That would be J&J, Moderna, and Pfizer. But when it comes to the mRNA shots, we see such an abundance of joint issues, heart issues. I had a guy call me the other day. He's a good friend of mine. I won't mention his name, but he has all of a sudden he's got stenosis in his aorta. He needs a valve replacement right away. And of course, I did ask him. I said, hey, were you vaccinated? He called me and said, dude, he said, I know this was from the shot. He said, I went and had this checked out 2 years ago. They saw it then and said, you won't need surgery for 15 years. Now, all of a sudden, it's that bad that he needs surgery immediately. And that's the kind of thing that we're seeing. We're seeing somebody who might have had a heart issue at 70. All of a sudden, it's coming out now at 40 or 50. You're seeing these young kids with pericarditis, myocarditis, inflammation of the heart muscle or the sac around the heart. These things are in abundance. So yeah, it definitely is cause and correlation. When you look at people who had studies 2 years before the shots that were completely fine, and then 6 months after these shots, there's a problem. And the reason we're finding them, Kevin, is called incidental findings. You go to the doctor for something completely unrelated, and all of a sudden we're finding, hey, you got an EKG that just doesn't look right, or you got inflammation here, or your kidneys look a little funky, That's the stuff we're starting to see, and it's directly correlatable to, the before and after. It's the only thing we've been doing in abundance for the last couple of years.
Oh, my gosh. This is so dire. How many people, and I know this is really, really a hard question, and I don't expect you to answer it, completely or scientifically or anything like that, but how many people, I think about all these young kids that took it, and they were pushing it on little kids to go to school or play sports. You got to give it to your kids. How much do we not know? I mean, this is not going away for the next 20 years. How many people out there, do you think it's in the millions, that this shot will affect somewhere down the road, that something happened that they don't even know about yet, and it's going to be a really difficult thing for them?
For the amount of microdata that we have, I do think it would be in the millions. I think that if you have something that, I tell people, look, for the majority of folks who got this, if they're relatively healthy, they should be okay, but just at an abundance of caution, get an EKG, get a checkup, go to your doctor, get some blood work done. And I hate to say go to your doctor because a lot of the same guys that you're going to get checked on now, from now, were the same ones that were recommending this thing in the first place, the same ones who closed your doors. You really got to take inventory of who you're going to and what you're seeing before you take advice. And ask that question we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast was based on what? When you have a pediatrician recommending a shot to a 5-year-old, and you don't ask the question based on what, ask that pediatrician, do they have experience with COVID, with testing, with other folks that have taken the vaccine? You're not doing your job as a parent. I would never tell somebody how to parent, but just as a human being, we should be asking those questions of professionals. I know a lot of bad doctors out there. I know a lot of good doctors out there, but you just can't look at somebody who has a degree and say, okay.
It's not what we learned though. We've always been taught you go to the doctor, consult with your doctor, take your doctor's advice, and most people will go with what their doctor recommends. Most people do that, which is why I never went to the doctor for COVID or to ask, should I get a shot? I just stayed away. I didn't want to hear a doctor say, hey, you should go take this, Kevin. If I'd heard that, I would have considered doing it. I still don't think I would have, because I'm a pretty strong-willed guy and have my own thoughts. And when I heard the word experimental, I'm like, hell no, because I just basically don't trust and believe in people that make a lot of these decisions. But man, that's just not the way of the world. That's the real crime here, is that most people, don't they, Dr. Schwartz, when they go to the doctor, they want to believe and trust their doctor and do what they're asked to do.
Yeah, you know, I write about this in the book a little bit. I have a cardiologist friend, and we were sitting at dinner one day, and he said to me, in front of a group of people, he said, you know, I used to recommend the shot all the time, and now I don't anymore because I saw the issues with it. And I looked at him, and I kind of cursed at him, and I said, what are you, nuts? And in front of the group of people, he said, what are you challenging me in front? And I said, dude, I said, you're a cardiologist. I said, we're primary care. So when we have an issue with cardiology, we send them to you for a reason. You have that expertise. I said, you know, your best answer at that point to that patient should have been, I don't know, because that was the honest answer. But by you giving an answer and just going with a narrative that you thought was okay because the CDC recommended it, it is now causing us all of these issues of credibility. Now everybody in the country is wondering, you know, if their doctor is credible at this point. I don't blame them. Same thing with the CDC, because they really screwed this up. I mean, in mass proportions. So that doctor and I had a frank conversation. He looked at me after that and said, you're right. And I said, well, I know I'm right, but I have a rule in my office, Kevin. My staff, when they're hired, I tell them, look, if you don't know the answer to a question, just simply say, I do not know. Because the first time you ever give me erroneous information, I'm going to question everything you say. You don't want that as an employee. You don't want that coming from me. So my staff is very clear on what they do know and what they don't know. And we knew COVID pretty early on. Like you said, we figured it out pretty early. We started testing on March 16th of 2020. By April 16th, 1 month in, when I had a couple hundred tests, we knew at that point that this wasn't what they were saying on television. So at that point, we started kind of questioning, wait a second. And it just kept going. I mean, a month after month after month, even when you get into the vaccines, you had doctors on TV talking about breakthrough cases. We never used the word breakthrough in our office because we knew that you were as susceptible as anybody else to catching COVID at least 120 days after the vaccine, because that is how long the antibody response lasts. And that's it. 120 days, like a flu shot.
Wow. I mean, this is just so amazing. So many things happened. And, you know, it really changed us. One of the things we did, I don't know if you've heard of this or not, maybe we're unique. I don't think I'm a very unique person. I think I'm a very common sense person. My wife and I have both changed doctors since COVID. Not for any particular reason other than we have found doctors that we know did not believe in the jab. They didn't want anybody to take it unless they were, you know, very sick or old or obese or diabetic or something. They were like, no, we didn't recommend the shot. We have switched to doctors that are like that. We changed our veterinarian for our dog. Get this. And I don't know if you heard stories like this or not, but remember back during COVID, they wouldn't let you come inside. So when we had to take our dog to the vet, they would come out to the parking lot with their masks on outdoors, take our dog through the window. He'd go inside. They'd do whatever he did. They wouldn't even let us in. Our dog hated this. He hated being pulled out of the car, taken from our arms to go inside. They're still doing it today at that veterinarian. And about a year and a half ago, I said, to hell with you people. If I can't come in there, I'm not doing business with you. I can't believe some of the decisions some people made during this thing. We just lost our freaking minds, didn't we?
You know, it's funny. No wonder Patrick Jockle set us up and introduced us, because you think a lot like I do. And I write about this in the book. It's in there. I mean, and if you your readers, your listeners go through it and you listen and you look at some of the stuff I wrote, I have an attorney who I went to that has an open air, you know, entranceway, and he's got one of those little 2x2 things hanging there just between you and the receptionist. I could go 6 inches to one side and I'm breathing on her, but this stupid thing is, and I said, dude, what are you doing? He goes, well, we want to make our people feel better. And I go, what do you mean feel better? Like, you're a medical expert now. You understand virology. You know, Kevin, I tell you, we never required a mask in our office ever in any of my offices, right? Because we do not wear them for viruses. If I was to take you on a tour of the Wuhan lab or the Winnipeg lab, and I said, hey, we're going to walk through the area where we keep all the viruses, but just put this cloth mask on, you'd think I was nuts. It just doesn't work that way. You know, we did a lot of stupid things during COVID. I refused to participate in the stupidity. We did things that were smart, and we told our patients that. I'd have patients that would walk in and see my staff and say, why aren't any of you wearing masks? And we kind of laugh and say, did you ever take a class in virology? Because I have. I don't come to your job and tell you how to flip the burgers. You shouldn't be telling me how to do what I do at my office.
Right.
But I think we made our patients feel a lot better. We talked a lot of people off ledges and about living life. And once they understood these things, you know, I'd get the dumbest things every day in my office, Kevin. It would be somebody who would walk in and say, I was exposed to somebody who was exposed mm-hmm. for 15 minutes. Can you test me for COVID? Like, were you serious? Like, what are we? You don't even have a symptom, and that's fine. We learned a lot by doing mass testing. So I would encourage people to do that because that's the only way the true numbers get out. There's a lot of folks like you who will come on, and I'll do a show with them, and they'll say, I never got a test. And I'll say, well, that's okay, fine. I get that you're trying to make a point. But when you test in abundance and you test the entire population, I live in New Jersey. It's 8.9 million people. If you tested all 8.9 million people at the exact same time in March of 2020, you would have found out very quickly that everybody had this. Most people weren't dying of it, and we could have stopped it in its tracks. But a lot of people didn't want to test. So mass testing really was the only way that we could derive that data. We did a lot of testing on antibodies, how long they lasted after natural infection, how long they lasted after the shots. And that is invaluable today. And all that information is in the book because we want people to understand it in totality.
That's awesome. My first several flights after COVID, when they started flying again, I wore a mask that said, this mask does nothing. And I got more thumbs up from flight attendants, pilots, people on the planes, professionals, but walking down the aisle, they'd give me a thumbs up than I ever had anybody come up and tell me I was an a-hole. I mean, honestly, I had people like looking at me going, thumbs up. We don't want to be wearing these things either. And for a while, I wouldn't fly. I'm like, I'm not going to put them. I'm just not traveling. I'm not going to this place. It's stupid. I'm not following their rules. And then I'm like, I kind of want to go play golf, you know? And so I got on a plane and I went and I played golf and I wore the mask. I said, this mask does nothing. And people kind of liked it. I think a lot was learned here. And I think your book is just going to be sensational. I wish you absolutely the very, very best with it. It's Fauci's Fiction, the book on COVID by Dr. Michael Schwartz. Pick it up wherever you buy books. You're also, in addition to being a former police officer, stand-up comedian, doctor, author, everything that you do, you're a body language expert. So I want to ask you about what, if you recall, when this was all happening, when we had the daily news conferences and everything else, and Fauci's standing there, and Trump's there, and the scarf lady's there, and the whole deal, do you ever remember watching any of those things, thinking, okay, I'm reading some body language here?
Yeah, you know, I did a little bit. And I derived that from being a police officer. We had many classes on it, and we developed a course on body language and communication. We teach it to just about anybody, you know, engineering companies. I've actually had the FBI that I've taught, some guys from the CIA. So it's an interesting take on trying to figure a narrative out. And in the beginning, it really did. I was glued to the TV like everybody else, and I'm watching these folks. And I'm thinking, okay, they look sincere. Like they're legit trying to figure out what's going on here and try to figure out, you know, because you got to remember too, Italy was like blowing up. People were dying and people in body bags. And I'm getting the same narrative from the folks at the hospital. There's reasons for that. This you know, this virus was novel. We didn't know how to treat it. And that was, you know, the protocols we were using were flaring things up. But as time went on and I'm listening to Fauci, and he came out and even verbally said, hey, why wear a mask? This is stupid. You're going to touch your face more. It's not going to do anything for a virus. And then all of a sudden they kind of changed the narrative. The one thing I do remember, Kevin, was when they were up on stage with the president there, you could tell by their body language that it was quite obvious that they weren't in sync with the president. And that came out pretty quickly once the president would say something and they would just kind of come out and say the opposite. You would go, all right, I mean, this doesn't make any sense.
And there's probably no way for you to tell, but you think that was personal or political or both?
I think a little bit of both.
Yeah.
At least just from kind of, you know, just lightly observing. Yeah. I wish I had, you know, FaceTime with these guys.
Here's what I noticed in Fauci about, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago when the question started coming, hey, did we do this right? Did you, you know, you said this and then you said this. He developed this tick or this tell. And I just want you to tell me what this means. I'll try to describe it, where he'd be asked a question and he'd look at you quizzically and he'd kind of crinkle his forehead and his eyes and his parse his lips together like this and look at you like, what kind of crazy thing you're asking me? What is somebody saying when they respond like that?
Well, usually that's called a micro expression when you're looking at their forehead. When somebody purses their lips together, that's a, you know, they're they're a little upset. They're it's now the word's escaping my mind because I've been doing COVID nonstop. But they're pensive. That's the word. So when you're pursing your lips, you're kind of pensive, and you're not exactly comfortable with the question. Now that's going to happen if you're getting grilled on Capitol Hill and you don't like a question. Obviously, he didn't like the question if he's pursing his lips and he's you know, those micro expressions leaking out of his forehead. So he didn't like the question. It's something he probably did not want to answer. Too many people kind of read into body language sometimes and they go, well, is the person lying versus are they telling the truth? Sometimes it's a little bit more vague than that. Sometimes it's are they comfortable with the question? Are they comfortable answering that question? If they're uncomfortable answering that question, you know there's something more there. Or at least they don't want that truth to come out.
Wow. All right, I know you're a huge baseball fan, so let's end with something fun here. You want to take a crack at who you think are the two teams going to be in the World Series this year?
No.
No?
because it's not my Yankees, and it's not your Royals. Right?
That's it? That's where it begins and ends with us?
Oh, my guys are horrible this year. I play in all the Yankee camps.
Seriously, you don't know horrible. All right, you're in last place, but you don't know horrible.
Well, I lived through the 80s when the Yankees never made it when I was a kid. And this reminds me of that. As a matter of fact, I had a meeting with one of the Yankee staff the other day. It's actually his former staff. He just left the Yankees. And he said, I think we're in for another, you know, round of like the 1980s, where they're just going to go through a period where there's nothing there and they have to rebuild because they have no farm system. So I know you guys are pretty bad, but, you know, for the Yankees to spend all that money, Aaron Judge, $360 million or whatever it was on his contract, I mean, he's pretty good, but they got nobody around the guy.
Yeah. You have a favorite Yankee player of all time?
All time, huh? Mm-hmm. I know
well,
a lot of the guys.
In your lifetime,
I was a big Donnie baseball fan. So wow. Don Mattingly was I wear that number. That's my birthday too, but I do wear 23. I play in all the Yankee fantasy camps. I do the Yankee tournaments. So I'm down in Tampa all the time. I have an office down there too, but yeah, that's what I wear. Number 23, Donnie baseball.
I was going to guess Jeter, but I'll tell you who I used to love watch play. And that was Bernie Williams.
Sure.
Just loved watching Bernie. Him play. And way back, Bernie. I loved Ron. I hated the Yankees, but there was something about Ron Guidry that I just loved.
The Gator. I'm going to be at an event with Tommy John tomorrow. And I think you air this the day I'll be there, but Tommy John and I are sitting at the table. He's really good friends with Gator, and I haven't met him yet, but I've heard many, many great stories about Gator.
That's awesome. I have a Billy Martin baseball from the 1976 playoffs. I won't indulge you with the long story. My listeners have heard it before, but it involves batting practice where he's standing out in right field before the game. Billy Martin is with Reggie and some others, and they're all out there, and the ball gets hit down to the corner, and my dad and me are at the game, and he's heckling him the whole time, throw the ball to my kid, throw the ball to my kid. My dad was kind of a loudmouth. We're standing there on the rail. Eventually, he tosses it to me, and my dad grabs it and throws it back down with a pen and says, sign it. Oh, my God. And Billy put that in his back pocket. It stayed there for the next 25 minutes as batting practice concluded, and he walked over when he was done, and he signed it, and he threw it up to me and said, your dad's an asshole, kid.
Oh, man, that's a cool story.
Those were the
that's
days,
a great
man.
Story.
Those were
have
the
you
days.
Have you seen, not to get off on top, we're a little on topic. Have you seen the documentary on Yogi Berra? It's called It Ain't Over.
I have not.
I'll give a plug for Lindsay Berra because Lindsay, his granddaughter actually produced it. It's a fantastic documentary on Yogi Berra, but you'll learn a lot about baseball and the old timers. I cried when I watched it. I would implore your listeners to check it out.
That's awesome. Dr. Schwartz, I'm a big fan, and congratulations on the book. And let's see if some of our listeners can get a few copies of that. We encourage everyone to go get a copy of Fauci's Fiction, the book on COVID. Dr. Michael Schwartz, you're a very, very interesting guy. Congratulations on your success, all the great work you're doing. And thank you so much for the book, and thanks for being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Well, thank you to Dr. Michael Schwartz. What a tremendous interview that guy is, and what an unbelievable book, Fauci's Fiction, the book on COVID. You heard it right there. He's having trouble getting it through on Amazon or getting any, you know, a lot of traction with this thing, but it's going to pop. I don't think there's any question about it. It's going to pop. He's too good of an interview. I'm going to predict right now that Dr. Schwartz winds up on Fox News. He'd be perfect sitting on one of those chairs for the Gutfeld show, talking about all this stuff, bringing his expertise. Since he's a stand-up comedian, he can bring jokes into it too. This guy is, I mean, the resume is just amazing. Too good to be true. Great stuff. thank you to our mutual friend listening, and I appreciate him setting me up because that was one terrific interview. Very, very interesting. Dr. Michael Schwartz. The book again is called Fauci's Fiction, the book on COVID. It was brought to you by Advantage Termite and Pest Control, online at AdvantageTPC.com, 913-768-8989 for all your residential or commercial pest control needs. And if you get critters, you got a squirrel in the attic or something really bothering you, whatever, give them a call. They'll come take it. They got critter control too. Advantage Termite and Pest Control, 913-768-8989. Amini's Galleria at 105th and Metcalf in Overland Park, also in St. Louis, Tulsa, and Oklahoma City. 60 months, no interest right now on outdoor furniture. R. Ash Amini has been a friend of mine for over 25 years. They are a staple in Kansas City with the greatest things for your man cave, like pinball machines, golden tee, pool tables, or the beautiful shuffleboard table that I got at Amini's. We also got some new bar stools, aminis.com, or visit them at 105th and Metcalf in Overland Park. And tickets for less, Billy Joel and Stevie Nicks, Saturday night, Arrowhead Stadium. Use the promo code KKHI. Save between 5 and 15% on your ticket purchase, your entire ticket purchase, by using that promo code. Or if you're looking at Chiefs preseason or remaining Royals games, it's all ticketsforless.com. Beyonce's coming to Arrowhead too. You will save money. Ticketsforless.com, promo code KKHI. That was fun, folks. I know that was a little different than most of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it because I certainly did. Right here, Kevin Keatsman has issues.
Thanks for listening to Kevin Keatsman Has Issues, presented by Roberts Robinson Chevrolet Buick GMC. To get exclusive patrons-only podcasts, receive a weekly newsletter, and attend in-person patrons-only parties, visit kkhasissues.com and become a patron today. This has been a production of Crooked Tail Media Incorporated.